Long used to being scolded from the right, the left is now copying it from the left. Voices within are asking how on earth the left can hope to change the world, while bickering amongst themselves about polite speech, hidden privilege, and the supreme truth over all other truths of lived experience. Where's Marx in all this? Whither Gramsci? One of those voices belongs to the British writer, lecturer, journalist, and political commentator, Ash Sarkar. She writes, "By making a virtue of marginalisation, breaking ourselves down into ever smaller and mutually hostile groupings, we make it impossible to build a mass movement capable of taking on extreme concentrations of wealth and power." Ash delivers these home truths in her first book, Minority Rule, and also at the Progress 2026 conference in Melbourne, which ended the other day. And she joins me now on the show. Ash, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And a warning, there's some tough language ahead. Now look, tell us about the response to Roger Hallam, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, when he gave the left a piece of his mind.
Am I allowed to use the words that he actually said? Because they're pretty salty.
Ash, you are.
Oh, wow. I forgot this is Australia and it's a term of endearment here.
That's right, which you know well, apparently, because of a close relationship you have with Australia.
I do. I have an Aussie housemate, so he actually taught me this word. So what happened is that I was in Liverpool and I was facilitating this big assembly. So the idea is there was about 200 activists and all of them are coming together to try and cohere a strategy for the left. And to stimulate debate, there were a few speakers. One was Roger Hallam, who co-founded Extinction Rebellion. And the thing you've got to know about Roger is that he's a bit like Gandalf, right? He's very urgent. He's got long grey hair and he's got that sort of impatience with faffing about. And he's like, you know, hobbits, what are you doing? You know, take the ring to Mordor. And so I asked him, you know, where do you think the left has been going wrong all these years? And he looked around the room and he had this very grave, meaningful expression. And he said that the problem was that we're all a bunch of fucking cunts. And that was...
And the response?
Everyone lost their minds. And just to say up top, you know, I think it's fine if you object to that language or you find it vulgar or you say, you know, we should be kinder to each other. That's fine. But people started making out that it was some kind of race issue or a gender issue. So you had this group of young people of colour who were saying, you know, we've been made to feel unsafe as POC. You had this person stand up in tears saying, Roger Hallam's brought violence into this space. And I was just thinking to myself, you know, we're supposed to be radicals and revolutionaries. You know, once upon a time, you'd be sort of marching into gunfire, trying to storm the Winter Palace, and you can't handle a climate activist saying the word cunt. And, you know, if you take that much offence to him calling you a bunch of fucking cunts, don't then try and prove him right with your behaviour. So that was a real moment of reckoning for me where I saw that years of having this hypersensitivity, this tendency to turn to victimhood instead of other forms of analysis or persuasion, it's not only made us kind of annoying, right, and like unattractive to be around, it's made us incapable of actually organizing together and working in a productive political way. So It was a crystallization of things that I'd been thinking for a long time. And, you know, Roger Hallam, God bless him, I don't think he knew what hit him.
But when did it start being this notion that we oughtn't to be offended? When did giving offence become this tremendous crime?
Well, you know, I think there's always been a bit of it, right? We've always had this negotiation over what kind of language you want to use for any group of people. I mean, in Victorian times, there was a huge, debate amongst, you know, the sort of therapists and scientists of the time of whether to call gay people inverts, catamites or urinists, right? Language has always been really contested.
Each of those descriptions is true.
It's like, look, choose your fighter, right?
Yes.
You know, you don't hear catamite as often as you once did, and maybe it's time for a comeback.
No, actually, catamites are a particular thing, aren't they? We can't approve of catamites.
We can't approve of catamites. You know, so there's always been this thing about how do we describe people? How do people describe themselves? Where it really took off is, I think, through the 90s and through the 2000s, where the left doesn't exist as a working class force so much. Trade union movements have been dismantled. Certainly in the UK, council housing got smashed to bits. You know, Australia, the story of deindustrialisation, that sort of fracturing and fragmenting of working class communities, that's happened here as well. That means that instead of left-wing politics being centred around working class experience and also working class struggle, people then encounter it at universities. And I can say this because I was one of these annoying people, right? If you do an arts and humanities degree, you're in a seminar like Hermione Granger, like you're always putting your hand up going, oh, pick me, pick me. And you're trained to pick apart language and other people's use of language in order to sort of inflate your own status. So that's a really bad combination, which is you've got left-wing ideas, which are supposed to be about social struggle, but then you're encountering them in a way where it's not about solidarity and it's not about what you can do together. It's about getting good grades and a pat on the head from teacher.
And analysing discourse. Discourse. And, yes, looking for the hidden ways of hurting people. I've always loved the example of the Methodists. You know, to be called a Methodist was a grave insult when that church got underway. And they decided to take that name as a way of disarming their critics. They called themselves Methodists. And the deaf in Australia refuse to be calling to be called hearing impaired. They say, we are deaf, and you take the language. But the prissiness of the language out there on the left, I mean, prissy language on the right is pretty awful as well, but it just takes up so much time.
It does. And I think you've used a really important word, which is discourse. I mean, you know, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think that's a really important part of study. But not everything from the academy should translate to politics. Do you know what I mean? Like some things are for the seminar room. Some things are for essays. And you don't have to make it the bedrock of what you're doing. And the problem with discourse is that you can say that people mean things even if they don't mean them. Because you go, oh, you're playing into this discourse. And it's like, but that's not what I actually said. That's not what I actually mean at all. So it introduces this suspicion and a lack of trust from the get-go. And so I sort of think that, and one of the issues is that ideas which have a place have been blown out of all proportion. So take symbolic violence, right? The idea of something being symbolically violent. Again, it's a useful term of analysis, but if you bring that into a room full of real people and you go, you're being symbolically violent, you can't get anything done.
And you'd be aware, because I'm no doubt it's happening in Britain as well, because it is certainly happening here, that there is a whole argument about shutting down debate, particularly debate over Israel, because it makes people culturally unsafe.
And the thing is that I'm sure that it does make people feel uncomfortable, but I always say that, you know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort. Right. Part of being an adult is sort of growing your capacity for being uncomfortable because that's what it means to interact with other people. But also on top of that discomfort, which I think is sincere, I also think there's a real weaponization of it for political purposes. So an example that I give in the book is that an organization called UK Lawyers for Israel pressured a hospital in London to take down a display of children's artwork because those children were from Gaza. And they argued, well, this makes Jewish patients feel unsafe. I couldn't actually find any evidence of Jewish patients themselves making complaints, so I can't say for certain whether or not it happened. But if it did, I think people need to get a grip. Children's paintings, they're not going to hurt you, you're going to be fine. And if they didn't, right, if that didn't actually happen, that shows you how powerful weaponized defense can be, especially when you invoke the victimhood of a minority community.
I'm very fond of giving people advice on the titles of their books, and I'm wondering whether you should have called your book, because you say it so often, Get a Grip.
I just think that if I said Get a Grip, I would be really veering into what I've always feared, which is becoming my mother, you know, just giving unsolicited advice all the time.
Do her words still come into your head?
Of course.
Unbidden? Yes. I know something of the problem. Hey, tell us about the Francis Crick bake sale.
Oh, my goodness. So this was a story that we covered at Navarra Media, which is the organisation I work for, which is a group of researchers wanted to put on a bake sale to raise money for medical aid for Palestinians. And just to say that as an organisation, the Francis Crick Institute, which is a science research institution, they were very supportive of the Ukrainian cause, for instance. It wasn't a new thing to say we're going to support this group of people who are facing a war of aggression. So they put on a bake sale, and then it was war by HR. So there were all these complaints going in saying, this makes me feel unsafe as a Jewish person, blah, 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 blah. And the institution said, all right, we're going to ban further bake sales for Gaza and also discussion of Gaza as an issue at the Francis Crick Institute. And again, this speaks to this thing of weaponized victimhood. But at no point was anyone able to sort of turn around and say, if you feel uncomfortable, get a hold of yourself, right? You can't, if you feel unsafe because of lemon drizzle cake, you better have a really rare form of aggressive diabetes, because that's the only good reason. You know, you have to be uncomfortable and eat that as a cost of social interaction. If you can't handle that people are going to express, you know, solidarity with the Palestinian cause, don't be in public. You know, that's a part of being part of political life.
And have there been further bake sales at the Francis Crick Institute?
Well, what I know about what followed is that there was a huge uproar from the researchers themselves. So while I don't know if there have been subsequent bake sales, there was definitely a huge backlash against this idea that you can't talk about Gaza. And in that regard, the Institute had to back down.
I'm surprised that the right even draws attention to this sort of behaviour, because it's doing them so much good. Why discourage it? Why make the left aware of the damage it's doing to itself by this kind of bickering over, you know, language and offence and things? Because it's just a boon for the right, isn't it?
Well, the thing is that the art of politics is making weirdos like us, right? Because it is weirdos who are really interested in politics. Weirdos like us presenting ourselves as the voice of the common sense, all right? And that's what the left want to do, that's what the right want to do, that's what the centre wants to do. So if you draw attention to this stuff, what you're essentially saying is these people aren't normal, they don't, you know, hold similar principles or values to you, and they're just kind of weird. So that's why the right do it. The thing that I would say, and this is where the book goes, is that while the left may have pioneered a lot of this stuff, the right have really taken it and run with it. So all of this stuff about hypersensitivity, you know, weaponization of grievance, talking about yourself as a victim, the right do that. But because they're doing that with majority identities, so, you know, invoking whiteness a lot of the time, they're going to have a better go of it because they've got more people on their side. And you must have had this in Australia where, you know, maybe you've got an advert or something where there's a mixed race family and you've got right-wing pundits freaking out saying it's not okay to be white anymore. It's that same sort of self-centered, narcissistic victimhood that may have sort of pioneered by left-wing activists, but the right have taken it and really gone with it.
Absolutely. And that's certainly the experience in Australia. I love the fact that you can absolutely responsibly defend certain identities while you're a crackpot for defending other identities. So you're a crackpot for defending, say, gay identity, but you're not a crackpot for defending the identity of a banker or a farmer or you know, those kinds of identities are fine and you fight for those, but do you find that in Britain as well, that there's a sort of strange blindness to how much the politics of the right is identity politics?
What's really interesting to me is that also the identities that they choose to defend change over time. So one of the chapters that I wrote looked at this idea of the chav. Now, chav is a bit of UK slang which was really big in the early 2000s, and it basically referred to anyone who was working class, they liked rap music, they wore Burberry. This was when Burberry was still seen as rather déclassé. And, you know, it was associated with criminality and being ill-educated. And you had all these journalists who would write about people who they thought of as chavs in the most disgusting, contemptuous term. So there was one journalist called James Denningpole who said these are lard-gutted slappers and they're dismal ineducables. And the people who they were talking about were by and large white, right? They really had it out for white people who they thought were just a bit too close to ethnic minorities. And then after 2010, 2011, where we had some really big riots, which were kicked off by the police killing a black man, but white people, young white people, did participate in those riots. Afterwards, you didn't hear the word chav anymore in media. Instead, you heard white working class. And the same journalists, including James Denningpole, who heaped scorn and disdain on those who they thought of as chavs, were now saying, isn't it awful? The white working class has been left behind. The left has nothing but contempt for these people. And so seemingly overnight, they went from going, you're chavs and we hate you, to you're the white working class and we're going to stand up for you.
Yes, but isn't it a rule of British politics, and it's certainly a rule in Australian politics, the Tories cannot rule without a chunk of the working class.
Mm.
You have got to divide the working class and bring a big chunk of it, as big as possible, with you as Tories. So this kind of divide and absorb politics is old, isn't it?
It is. And I would say that that was kind of a 40-year project. So Margaret Thatcher, and I take one of the chapter titles from something she said, which is economics is the method that object is to change the heart and soul. And a big part of the sort of theoretical underpinning of my book is that we don't just organically, magically think of ourselves in certain ways. It's a product of our environment. Conditions shape our consciousness. So when you had the really strong trade union movement, when you had council housing, when you had heavy industry, which held working class communities together, you had a shared political subjectivity. But then all those things got smashed to bits. So not only does the working class become a lot more dispersed and fragmented geographically, that's also mirrored by how people think of themselves. So council housing sell-offs, this was a huge thing in the UK. Right to buy got introduced. And then instead of people buying those council homes for themselves, people bought it, they sold it on, and then they've fallen into the hands of private landlords. So it created this whole new class of people with a different set of economic interests who then think of themselves in a different way. So not only do the Tories need those working class voters that you talk about, they do that through certain kinds of narratives, saying we're for you, we're standing up for the white working class, but they also do that through introducing economic policies that can take the working class and introduce competing interests.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Ash Sarkar, British journalist, author of a book called Minority Rule, and a critic of the, how shall we call it, Ash, the sort of fragmented nature of the left. Fragmented and also unambitious.
Mm.
I wonder whether this sort of bickering about victimhood and the proper language to use and I'm feeling unsafe and all of this stuff is a sign that there's no big ambition left on the left anymore, that the notion of changing the world is out the window.
I think you've got it bang on there. I think where it comes from is, you know, decades on decades of political defeat, not having experience of organising and winning. So what you do is you go for what's proximate, what's close by, rather than what's strategic, the thing that you really ought to go for. Now, I do actually feel that we're coming out of this a bit. Certainly in the UK, we're coming out of it. And I think that the sort of, you know, hyper-identitarian, turbo-offended culture is sort of coming to an end. What needs to follow that is embracing strategy, embracing analysis, and not just falling back on moral arguments, you know, the ones which are like, well, I'm right and you're wrong. These people are good. These people are bad. We need to actually talk about strategy. How do we respond to the crises of our time in a way which maximizes our chances of winning?
Another way of me putting the same question, perhaps, is that while all these little arguments are going on, the real power in politics, money, is not being addressed at all.
Well, I've got a, you know, seeing as I'm in Australia, I have to talk about Macquarie, right? Macquarie.
You mean the bank, not the former governor, yes.
Yep. The bank Macquarie came to the UK and they bought up our water utility, Thames Water, which supplies water to London and the southeast. They loaded the company with debt. They paid out tons of money to their shareholders. They drove it into the ground financially, and then they just left. They just sold it and they moved on. And what I find crazy about this whole story is not only am I stuck paying much higher water bills because I'm dealing with this debt mountain that's been created to pay off shareholders and CEO bonuses, Macquarie has been let back into the UK to buy up part of our gas network. So one of the things which I argue is that politicians don't serve the people who vote for them, right? They don't serve the electorate. They don't serve citizens. What they do is they serve corporate and oligarchic interests. So a company which should have been banned from participating in any part of the UK economy after what they did to Thames Water, they've been welcomed back in with open arms. And, you know, I don't want to assume about what they've been up to in Australia, but if this is what they did to us, it can't be good over here.
But aren't you talking about a fundamental pattern of politics that goes back centuries?
Yep, absolutely. And the thing, and this is the importance of Marx in the book, is that I'm not talking about Marx in terms of his predictions for the future necessarily, more in terms of his analysis of how social change happens. So what he says is that you get those big transformations of the 18th and the 19th century because one class, which is, you know, the bourgeoisie, the middle class, the traders, the capitalists, they've gotten big enough and bad enough to overthrow the one that's above it. And he sort of thought that it was inevitable that the industrial working class would do the same. Now, that hasn't happened. So what we have to do is think about what are the kinds of coalitions we can build amongst that economic majority, which can transform how politics is done. Because I think that whether you're left wing or you're right wing or somewhere in the middle, all of us sort of understand that the politics that we've got is a reflection of the balance of class forces in society. And so we're not going to get anywhere just through persuading or signing petitions or being like, oh, please, Mr. Politician, can you introduce this policy? You know, we've got to find and exert some leverage.
What do you call yourself?
I call myself a fan of Tottenham Hotspur and also a communist.
And as a communist, do you... are you looking to an analysis of society or the transformation of society? I mean, do you look at some point in the future for public ownership of the means of production?
So I'd say a little of column A and a little of column B. So certainly I'm very communist in my analysis and I've talked about how important Marx is to me in sort of establishing the scaffolding through which I understand things. Also, you know, the works of Antonio Gramsci, really, really important. In terms of transformation, I do think that when we have the commodification engine, so the turning of things which are the product of human free association into commodities for profit, we see that those things get worse. And the example I always give is dating apps, all right? No one likes being on dating apps. No one enjoys being on the app. You'd much rather be at a pub or at the club meeting people. But this commodification engine has taken something profoundly human, our desire for love and connection, gamified it and made it worse. People treat each other worse because of the apps than they did before because, you know, you can ghost someone that you don't know. So I'm not necessarily talking about state ownership of everything. I don't think that a big, cumbersome Soviet model is actually good. What I'm talking about is being able to ring fence the things that really matter and to protect them from commodification and to say, no, actually, this cannot be owned. This is going to stay in the commons, part of what we all have access to, part of what we all share, and no one can make this an engine for money.
Do you see any signs that the left is actually getting a grip?
Yeah, I do, actually. So in the UK, in some ways, our situation mirrors Australia, is that we've got a Labour government with something of a supermajority. What's different about the UK is that we don't have mandatory voting. So this Labour government, headed up by Keir Starmer, was able to win a massive parliamentary majority on fewer votes than the party got in 2019, which was a humiliating defeat. And so in that context of an unpopular Labour leader and a sandcastle majority, our Green Party has sort of taken up the mantle of economic populism, going really hard on the cost of living, cost of housing, stuff like that. And they've now overtaken Labour in the polls and they've inflicted a by-election defeat quite recently in Manchester Gorton.
Yeah.
So that tells me that, you know, we're learning some lessons and that we understand that if you want to win, you know, a majority for an electoral project, you've got to speak to issues which the majority of people experience.
Being
the cost of living. I mean, you know, there's a wonderful thing. I mean, it's not wonderful in a good way. What I mean is it's sort of spectacular, is that in 2021, 2022, when interest rates got spiked, homeowners who've been paying mortgages suddenly started feeling a lot like renters. You know, the cost of my housing's going up. I've got no control over it. And I've got to squeeze myself ever harder if I want to keep my house. And renters are like, welcome to the club, jump on in, the water's horrible. You know, quite quickly, if you focus on the cost of living, you realise that all these different groups of people who might have very different cultural experiences, very different political worldviews, and before may have had different economic interests, actually we start all experiencing ourselves the same way.
The profound impact of private ownership of housing on politics. But Ash, you've been in Australia for a few days.
I have.
It may be your first visit to Australia.
It is.
We like prominent visitors to this country to say something nice about us while they're here. Can you say anything nice about the Australian left?
I can say loads that's nice about the Australian left. I mean, the first thing I'll say about being in Melbourne is that it's a beautiful city. It's like London, but clean, warm, and people are friendly, which is fab. And in terms of the Australian left, is that going to Progress and meeting people who are part of Indigenous rights movements or housing movements from Brisbane or people who are working with gender-based violence, is that there's not only a lot of energy, there's a lot of seriousness. And also what I saw was a willingness to self-critique and go, what hasn't served us? How can we leave that behind? And how can we consolidate on our successes and things that work? And it took the left getting its ass kicked multiple times in the UK for us to get to that place. So the fact that you're already there makes me think, you know, healthy political culture.
Ash, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've had a great time.
I've been speaking to Ash Sarker, British journalist, author of a book called Minority Rule, available in good bookshops. This is Late Night Live.